Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, y'all. Welcome back to a Saturday, May 14th, 2022 edition here on the Chase Thomas Podcast, where I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Jam-packed show for you guys today. Very excited to dive into this podcast with you guys today. We got Go Big Orange Friday with Ethan Stone and Ryan Schumpert to talk all things Tennessee basketball, baseball, and football. That's not all, though. No, we also dove into some Iowa Hawkeyes. So the Iowa Hawkeyes, who just wrapped up spring ball, a really weird year last year for the Iowa Hawkeyes, because they were a team that they were good last year, obviously, with their defense and their takeaways and just being, I think, number two in the country at one point. And you're like, oh, are they just Georgia of the North? And things obviously did not end that way. A lot of folks remember the Michigan Big Ten title game, but just trying to get a good feel of where Iowa is going into this year, and losing what they lost on both sides of the ball, and how they're going to bounce back, why they don't really dip into the portal, the culture at Iowa, their biggest strengths going into next year, where Spencer Petras is in the pecking order, and what the quarterback situation looks like there, why offense at Iowa is different, and how it relates to their defense, and all that and more with Tom Kakert of the Iowa Rival site, which was just a lot of fun, and he does a great job, and they do a great job over there at Hawkeye Report. So check that out. Keep up with them if you have not already done so. Also having a sneaky good baseball season. So all that and more coming up on this edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Don't forget, folks, you can watch this very program on YouTube, youtube.com, type in the Chase Thomas Podcast. You'll find us right there. All of our episodes, all that good stuff, Chase Thomas Podcast on YouTube. So if you prefer to watch and then listen, guess what? We got you covered. Don't forget, folks, you can also leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify if that is how you're listening to today's show. And if that is, please make sure you pause and leave this show a 5-star rating and review. It helps other people find the show, and it helps this show continue to grow. Apologies on this coming out a little bit later on Saturday than usual. Kind of a busy night and start to my day. So final, still trying to wrap up here at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. So I'm kind of swamped still for the next couple days, and we're going to see how the schedule all unfolds. Might go to Tennessee, Georgia this afternoon as we wrapped up. Already won the series after last night, but you know, good stuff. And then the raccoon in the Arkansas game was incredible. If you haven't already, go onto twitter.com and check that out. Fan barehanding a raccoon and escorting him out the building. So the Guardians of the Galaxy sequel, or I guess trilogy, looks pretty good so far. So All that and more coming up on today's show. Thank you guys for tuning in to the Saturday edition here on the Chase Jones Podcast. I greatly appreciate it. All right, Uncle Darren, let's go.
Chase Thomas Podcast. The Chase Thomas Podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, we're back. Go Big Orange Friday on a Friday afternoon. We're actually taping this on a Friday afternoon, which works because guess what? It is Go Big Orange Friday. Ethan Stone of the UTK Daily Beacon. Until what? What? How much longer can I introduce you in that fashion, Ethan?
Technically, you can't anymore. I think Tuesday was my last day, but I'm gonna consider myself as such until graduation, which is next Saturday. So
there you go. I saw Ethan on campus earlier this week, and I didn't know what to do because Ethan made eye contact with me and he made a weird face at me, and I was driving away and I was like, I don't know if I should stop. I've already been moving for a little bit too long. And then he was with his family clearly. And I was like, I don't really want to get out and like do the whole, like explain like, he's on my podcast. And like, I know, and then do that whole song and dance with his family. So I was like, I'm just going to keep moving. And I also don't know if he 100% saw me. It was an amazing, a lot of decisions and thoughts went in like a 7-second period. And then Ethan slid in my DMs like, that was that you? And I was like, yeah, that was absolutely me. Yeah.
You could tell both of our collective minds were really going overdrive, because like, I saw you, but you were driving on Circle Park. So I was like, I'm like 80% sure that's Chase, but I didn't know for sure. So I was like, you know, cause I don't want to wave.
Yeah.
It's just some random dude.
No, yeah. It worked out. It was me. I should have messed with you and been like, I'm in Atlanta this weekend.
What are you talking about, man?
Yeah. Also here, Ryan Shumpert of the Rocky Top Insider. Ryan, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Doing well. Glad I wasn't involved in that interaction this week, because those are the social interactions that just eat away in my head. So
yeah.
I'm glad I got to avoid the awkward car with the family, hesitance. I actually had when I went to the Nashville SC game on Wednesday, and I had a somewhat similar interaction there. So didn't completely avoid it for the week, but at least I didn't double dip like you guys.
It was funny because I also this week, it's just been because I've had to be on campus a bunch this week with finals and wrapping up stuff. That's where I'm heading back after this. So I haven't even been able to watch as much as I need to watch. And I don't know. Well, I might try and go to the Georgia game tonight, but we were in the elevator in Hodges, and it was like three people in it, and I was the only person who could see this other kid like kind of hustling towards the elevator, and I was like, we're kind of full. So I just like stared at him. We made eye contact as the door closed, and he was expecting me to hit the hold the door open button, and I just kind of made eye contact and was like, that's not happening, man. This is a full elevator, and you're not getting that close to my proximity. I need you to sit. And it was just the sadness when he saw that, like, it was like this close. And then I just saw him like, oh, brutal. But I, can't do it, man. Can't do it. I don't like packed elevators. It's just, it's awkward. I don't know, but it is interesting. Like, people really like immediately, they get so uncomfortable in elevators. I've noticed is like, especially girls, they come in and then they're like immediately phone and they're like, like just extremely, extremely fast. And nobody like elevators for whatever reason are just not a fun thing, but that concludes story time on campus this week, I think. I don't think there was any other crazy thing I did. No, I think that was about it. Well, we're going to start off with some big UT basketball news that Julian Phillips, 5-star kid, he commits to the University of Tennessee. Barnes gets a 5-star once again, his 6th 5-star since being the University of Tennessee basketball coach. There was a lot of questions we talked about on this podcast of like where things were going this offseason, and that they were losing a lot. And we still don't know for sure with Josiah Jordan James. His name's still in the NBA draft. He could still technically go, but people just assume that he's going to just dip his toes in and come back for one more year. But we don't know until he does it. But by and large, this is another big get for Barnes and people who are concerned, like, oh, NIL, how does this change Rick Barnes? How much is he going to be in on NIL? And how comfortable is he with this? He's 67. Is he up for this? And it's like, I think at this point, I'm good with what Barnes is doing, and he's going to get the guys. He's going to fill up this roster. He's going to get a couple more guys. Like, he's recruiting's going to be fine. We're not going to fall off a cliff there. And there's just an understanding now where it's like Keon goes first round, Springer goes first round, Kennedy Chandler is probably going to go first round. That if you go to Tennessee now and play for Rick Barnes, I mean, you can go back to Durant, which I think Phillips is like one of his guys, is like he loves Kevin Durant, so I'm sure there was some crossover there. But you're in good hands. And if you spend a year with, if you're Phillips and you develop and you play hard and you play with this defense first identity and you play on a team that should be in the top three in defensive KenPom and be right there in the thick of things in the SEC, then you'll probably go in the first round. And that's a good selling point. It's like, you know, you'll be taken care of and you'll be good at UT under Barnes. But Ethan, what do you make of the Phillips sign? Were you surprised? And do you think that it's the right fit for what Tennessee needed?
I think it's a great fit. I'm not necessarily surprised. I thought it was going to be between Tennessee and Auburn myself. Mm. G League, I know they offered them like, I think I saw like $800,000 or something like that, which is insane. But it kind of talks about what you were talking about, just NIL and the fact that obviously Barnes and Tennessee and whoever you want to say as far as the interest groups go are able to kind of fork over the cash, because obviously that is a major factor here. But, I mean, you know, Phillips, LSU guy, was going to go to LSU before the mass exodus there, before everyone leaves after Will Wade gets fired. 6'8", he plays like a wing. He's just tall. I saw someone give him an NBA contract towards Mikal Bridges, which I think is kind of fair. But he's really got everything. If you watch him, on lobs, he's driving to the basket. He finishes like he's 6'2", not 6'8". And obviously the height difference will give him a bit of an advantage there, but it's going to be a solid player. I think he'll fit kind of what Josiah does, maybe not as well defensively, obviously Josiah being more of a veteran, veteran presence there. I think it'll be interesting to see how, I guess, he's put in the starting lineup or rotational to start out. I would say he'd be a starter immediately. I mean, he's definitely got the talent for it. It kind of depends on if Josiah and Tonti come back, which I expect them to. But I think he's going to bring a lot to the table for what Barnes is going to do, especially considering, and as Ryan pointed out, I saw on Twitter, Tennessee does so well small ball, and his ability to be able to like stretch the floor offensively, I feel like, because he can shoot the three well. As well as a 6'8" guy could shoot it. So I think it's going to be very interesting watching Tennessee move forward with this kind of lineup, just the amount they can play around with it.
I think so too. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, well, for one, credit to Phillips and his camp. I mean, when's the last time you remember a 5-star committing in the morning that he was committing? Like, no one seemed to know where he was going. It was pretty cool. Like, it felt like an old-fashioned recruitment in that way. And no, I think Ethan hit the nail on the head on a lot of it. You know, I think maybe if you're looking exactly what Tennessee needed, you'd say, hey, go get a low post score. That's what they didn't have last year, and Phillips isn't that. But at the same time, there's – maybe I'm missing someone, but I don't think there's a low post scorer out there in the transfer portal or the prep ranks that's as effective as a player is Julian Phillips. And while he may not bring – the interior scoring that is more of a permanent need for Tennessee, and this is kind of what Ethan was getting at with my tweet, I think it opens up all sorts of really fascinating lineups and possibilities for Tennessee to stretch defenses next year, because Tennessee's best offensive lineup without a shadow of a doubt was that Josiah at the four lineup last year. And the thing was, he was going to play some at three. He couldn't be on the court at all times. He was going to be at foul trouble. And they really didn't have another person they could put in that slot. Jemai Meshach, they had him play there a little bit of the four, but he still wasn't an offensive threat, so it really didn't space the floor any different than having a second big man on the court. Now with Phillips, you have two guys that can guard four men and then at the same time stretch the floor offensively. I think Phillips, a lot of it's going to be, he's a freshman. How does he come in and adapt to the defense-first mindset that you have to, if you're going to play a lot in this program, you have to have. But if Rick Barnes can get him to buy into that, I think really the sky is the limit for what he can do at Tennessee next year. And really what the sort of lineups Tennessee can do to attack teams or attack defenses, I think, really open up and could be really, really interesting.
Yeah, there was not another big you were going to replace BHH with in the portal or anything else. It was just kind of like, now you're going to lean more on wing depth. I think there's going to be more switchability with Tennessee. There's going to be more length. And it slides JJJ to the four, I think, permanently. I'm curious what this means for Kumwa and if he's a starter on next year's team or what you do there, because it, like, Euros came on late. Is it Aidoo? You need to, because it, I mean, that would probably be my preference, is Aidoo at the, like, you could go super big here. You could go, you could even have Vescovy at the one. You could go Vescovy, Phillips, Kumwa, JJJ, and Aidoo. You could go, there's a lot of different things that Barnes can do, and as we learned this past year, he's going to mix and match, and he's not going to be afraid to switch up the rotations and figure stuff out. But with Victor Bailey, Justin Powell both being gone, this is like the kind of wing depth where it's like, oh, it's more of a proven commodity on the wing that Barnes doesn't have to just like throw. Oh, like the fan base doesn't have to go, okay, we have to find somebody on the wing who can create their own shots, somebody on the wing who can do something kind of like what Kiam was able to do 2 years ago when he was healthy. It's like, we did not have that last year. It was a lot of reliance on the guards. It was a lot of reliance on the driving kick and finding open shooters. And it was clunky at times. And I think the offense will be a little bit more opened up here, because I don't think we'll be as big heavy as we were a year ago. But I am curious, does this mean Sakai is going to start at the one? Like, is that going to be his time now? Or does Barnes want to keep him in the six-man role that he excelled in? So I don't know. I think it's another piece that's a good sign for Tennessee, that high upside guy. I think he'll at the very least be a strong defender, and Tennessee's defense is just going to be another pain in the butt next year. But I'm excited. Like, I wonder if Yuri Collins comes and you still get Tyreek Key, then you're like, this roster is complete. We're good. Like, I don't think anyone has any concerns that Tennessee should be the, at least, you can't say favorite just because of how stacked the SEC is now, and you can make the case that the SEC is the best basketball conference in college basketball now. That I don't know. I'm with Arkansas, with Alabama, with Kentucky, with Auburn a little bit, but like, there's going to be a lot of good teams that they're going to have to challenge at the top of this conference next year. But by and large, I think it's going to be another great team, and Phillips is kind of like a last, like, big thing. I don't think there's another big name on the horizon. I know, listen to the Fall Quest guys, they expect another European name to just pop up out of nowhere. I think Rob Lewis talks about it. He's like, he's gonna come, I don't know who it is, he's gonna pop up on the radar, and it's gonna be like a Euros and a Santi, and you're like, okay, I guess he's just gonna be a great player for Tennessee for 3 years that we did not know existed. That's somebody to watch out for. But I'm curious, like, who do you think is the lead ball handler next year, Ryan? Who do you think is the starter at the one?
Yeah, it has to be Sakai. I don't see any other option with Yuri Collins going back to St. Louis, not transferring. I mean, I think that would have been the other option. I think that's kind of, I thought it was interesting you mentioned him, because when Tennessee got Phillips yesterday, I think that's kind of the one, his versatility, I think, releases a lot of the worry about the depth of the big men and losing BHH. I think that's a much smaller concern now. And so that is, to me, the one other roster concern is, I see one ball handling guard that you trust in Sakai. I don't see a second one. And Collins would have been that guy. So I think that is a tough loss. Who ends up being it? I think that's a really big question right now, because obviously they're going after Tyrese Hunter. That one is a very crowded recruitment, far from a lock, or even Tennessee being the favorite necessarily. And I think you may end up with a lot of pressure on BJ Edwards, because while Vescovy is capable of handling the ball, just look at the jump he made last year, and it wasn't all because he was playing off ball, but I think that was a big part of it, and the strength of his game, I think, besides just the straight up shooting, which just goes with the shooting, is how well he moves off the ball, and he's not doing that when he's running the point. So while that's an emergency option, something you can go to at all costs, that's not what I would want to be doing if I was Tennessee. And right now, the only other guy on the roster really is Sakai, and BJ Edwards kind of being a question mark, and how much maybe Tyreek Key kind of feels like that would be similar to Sakai, similar to Vescovy, where he can play somewhat if needed, but not a true point guard. So when I'm looking at where they have three roster spots still left to fill, to me, that's the only thing that they really need, is to add another ball handler. And besides that, and I guess this is me rambling a little bit now, when Tennessee was missing on some of these guys, I wasn't necessarily, I think, hitting the panic button as much as other people, because really Tennessee's, the core of its roster is back. And while they have whatever it was, five at the most spots to fill, they don't have a whole lot of starting spots to sell. They really had one, and that was probably big in getting Julian Phillips. There was what you felt really confident about, four guys you were going to have in the starting lineup. And it's hard to go get really good guys, and especially in the NIL and especially in the transfer portal. era if you're not having big time minutes and then maybe some added incentives in there to get them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's pivot to the baseball team. So Tennessee baseball, they win last night against Georgia. They get the black uniforms out on Tuesday, and there were some real sickos covering that game I saw on Tuesday night. Couldn't be me. Could not be me. But this is it. The homestand wraps up here. Mississippi State on the road next weekend, which before the year we were like, oh, what a great way to end the year is the defending champs in the College World Series. And they're not even making the NCAA tournament. They're out. Like, this has just been a really, really rough year in Starkville following their magical run last year. But what are you looking for out of this Georgia series, and what did you already learn from last night's game?
Well, I think, for one, it was just interesting to see the pitching. We knew they were mixing it up, going with Chase Dolander to open the series, and then Blade Tidwell staying in the game too. Chase Burns came out of the bullpen, so that answers the question of who's going to start on Saturday this week in game three. And that, I think, is still the biggest question, is they're getting into range where there's some of these weekends you're going to need four starters, SEC tournament being one of them, a regional potentially being another one. But still, super regional, you're still going to have one order is extremely important, who's going to pitch in those big games. So I think figuring out exactly who they like in what role, and Vitello said as much after the game Thursday night, that they want all those guys to at least come out of the bullpen once, all those four starters, because that gives them experience they need. And to me, I thought it was interesting that, and they may flip it up next weekend at Mississippi State, but I thought it was a little interesting that Beam is getting the start on Saturday and not Burns. I thought, really, Beam is more of a natural fit to me coming out of the bullpen with just his ability to throw strikes. He's just such a natural strike thrower, and both Tidwell and Burns, when they have struggled, it's been a lot of times a command issue. So I think that's really interesting to watch. The offense, the warm weather is here in Knoxville, and home run balls are getting out quickly at Lindsey Nelson. So I think that'll be interesting to follow, and maybe even on a different note, how does Tennessee, especially these next 2 weekends on the road and in Hoover in a bigger ballpark, how does Tennessee manufacture runs when it's not the home run ball?
Part of me wants to kind of lose. I kind of want to lose in the tournament. I don't want to be number one. Like, that whole stat about the number one overall seed and the best team in college baseball winning the tournament and winning in Omaha. It's just, what is it, 20 plus years that has not happened?
Yeah.
That's just, it's kind of scary. But I don't know. Ethan, what do you make of last night's game and the state of the pitching rotation at the moment?
I didn't watch too much of last night's game, but I kind of want to go off what you were saying about being number one. I've noticed the bits I have watched that Tennessee's just not hitting as well as they were in the beginning of the season. That's a tall ask, obviously. Mm. But, you know, going into Mississippi State this weekend, I remember I said I thought Mississippi State would be the one that maybe, because it's on the road, might give the Vols from trouble. Obviously, Kentucky seemed to have filled that role.
Mm.
They kind of, I mean, if Kentucky's beating you, there's a little bit of a problem, because, I mean, I get it's just one series and the weather wasn't great at the time, but I feel like this is not the time for Tennessee's bats to be slightly tapering out. And like Ryan said, you know, if they're relying on the long ball too much or having problems getting the ball in the infield and stuff like that, I combined with your number one, what you said there about that, I feel like it's asking for trouble going into a Hoover. As far as the rest of this weekend, I don't think Tennessee will have too much trouble with Georgia. Not really, especially at home with the magic number being 2 and ability to win the SEC tonight if I think Vanderbilt beats Arkansas. So I think they'll go pumped up into that. I'm just a little worried that they'll get to Mississippi State and they'll just be like, yeah, we've already done it. You know, that's one thing I feel like this team really needs to prove is, like, they're not going to get ahead of themselves. Like, they got to, you know, see the target in front of them and actually go towards it I guess finish, you know, because that's obviously what's most important going into Omaha into a series like that.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We still got a lot of baseball to be played, and enjoy it. Like, this season will never happen again. Like, this is a once in a lifetime type situation for Tennessee baseball. But and that's not to say like the program's not in good shape. It's just this kind of collection of talent and this kind of roster and everything going this way is just a rarity. Let's end on Tennessee football. So Brew McCoy officially in the building. We know that now. Jalen Robinson's making his announcement over the weekend. So we'll see what happens there, but seems like that's pretty positive and pretty likely that he's going to end up on Rocky Top. especially with this background at UCF and Heupel, and the difference between playing with Gus Malzahn this past year and what happened with that offense after Dylan Gabriel went down versus what he'll be able to do with Hendon and company. He'll probably be able to play right away with this Tennessee team this fall. It's kind of funny. We were talking about it in the podcast. I'm not sure if it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, but who do we think between Robinson and Brew? And now it's like, well, they're just going to get both. And, you know, there's a lot of young talent to like in Knoxville right now with Webb, with Miller, with Squirrel, with just up and down the list. And we'll see what happens with Carnell Tate, who still has not declared, and we don't know when that's coming. But, the receiver room's in good shape, and then our old friend Ramel Keaton. But, you know, this is something that I think is actually will put a lot more Tennessee fans at ease, because if you talk to any Tennessee fan here in Knoxville about Tennessee football and just the depth chart, they'll be like, oh, I don't know about Jalin Hyatt. Like, there's a lot of people who will never be totally sold on Jalin Hyatt being a consistent slot guy and someone you rely on for 12 games. Like, the talent's there and the talent's always been there, but you just kind of feel better if you had the alternatives. And one of the things that was interesting last year was this, that Javonte Payton was kind of, he was a big part of this team early on, and he had obviously a great game against Bama, and he had a lot of great games, great game against Kentucky, and he was good. But I think Robinson can be used in that same way, but now they have more depth on the outside, where now it's not just Cedric Tillman as your only get up and grab the ball type guy. Now you have Brew on one side, theoretically, and his size. You have Cedric on the other, and now you have a lot more options. And if Jalen's just a slot guy, the two Jalens, I guess, is what we're going to call them, double J, if they're both in the building. But you just feel good. Like, it just feels like there's more depth, and it all makes sense. Like, the wide receiver room just looks complete and looks like something that Heupel really, really wants, right?
I think so. And I think I said it that day that in a lot of ways, Jalen Robinson made more sense. But more than anything, Tennessee needed an outside guy, and Brew McCoy is that. And the old, I feel like they said it a ton about the Butch Jones receivers, analysts would, the power forwards receiver. Mm. Now Tennessee's got two of them with Cedric Tillman and Brew McCoy. I mean, physically, those guys are as good as it gets. And I think you're right. It's just, you feel better. Oh, there's promise with those young guys, but it's just like we were talking about in the basketball section with B.J. Edwards. There's promise there, but you'd feel a lot better to have more options and have competition in those spots, and that's what McCoy gives you, and that's what Robinson would give you if he does decide to come to Tennessee, and that certainly takes a little bit of the pressure off of those four freshman receivers. And I think the pressure is still on Jalin Hyatt either way, but maybe a little less pressure on the Jimmy Holiday, the Jimmy Callaway, those other junior receivers who have played some, have shown potential, Callaway probably more than Holiday, but at the same time haven't gone out there and shown it consistently. It's just good to have extra bodies.
What do you think, Ethan?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jalin Robinson's a hypothetical. That would be great. In my opinion, I would say Robinson is still the better prospect between him and McCoy, because, as I've said before, I'm just not 100% sure if McCoy is even going to get to the field. I mean, we got to remember, this guy hasn't played in a year and a half. You know, and he's going to be going in Heupel's up-tempo offense. You know, I mean, this is going from not playing to you are running at all times all over the field. And like Ryan said, he's got the talent, obviously. I want to see him get there, personally. Getting to Jalin Robinson, I feel like if he gets here, especially knowing Heupel, I say he's the wide receiver too immediately, right behind Tillman. And then regardless, like you said, Chase, I think Jalin Hyatt, the pressure is going to be on him, because he's been, for a year now, the guy that people are like, hey, you need to step up. You need to be our wide receiver too last year. And it was obviously Payton as the wide receiver too. At least I'd say producing more than he did. So I feel like Hyatt, you know, needs to take that next step, regardless of whether Jalin Robinson, Brew McCoy get playing time over him. And I mean, I think he can do that. And like Ryan was saying, with Jimmy Callaway and Jimmy Holiday, really, you just got a lot of dudes that can really produce. And I feel like kind of a plug-in thing with Heupel's offense, I feel like it'll work fine. I'm not really scared for the future of the wide receiver room, but it could get really, really, really good if Jalin Robinson and Brew McCoy make the field. It's coming to you.
Yeah, and one of these young guys is going to pop and take away some time. And that's the whole thing. It was what Ryan's saying is that, like, you want the competition, because one of these dudes is going to pop as a freshman and be like, oh, we're going to hear the reports of, like, hey, he's turning heads. Like, this dude's going to get a better role because he's doing X, Y, and Z, and he's going to see his way on the field, and he's going to be this. I just think it's a good thing to be. It's a good problem to have. It's just too many receivers, and I think it'll be fine. It's also just nice to see, because Cody Burns leaving when he did, you were like, uh-oh, is this a problem? Because he takes a New Orleans Saints wide receiver coach job, and there's just uncertainty. Like, Kelsey Pope, by all accounts, you promote from within, and there's the continuity there, but you still don't know if it's going to keep up. But since he's been installed as the new receiver coach, Tennessee hasn't missed a beat. Like, you still bring in Brew, you still might bring in Jalen Robinson. Like, I think they're just going to be humming on all cylinders with or without those guys. So I'm excited about that. I am concerned, though, with, I think there's two areas that I don't know if they're gonna be able to fix in the portal, and that's the tackle spot and that is the corner spot. Like, Tennessee really, I would feel a lot better because I think the pass rush spot is kind of wrapped up. I don't know what they're gonna do there. I think they're just kind of like, we got our guys for the time being, but we'll see. Maybe adding another defensive tackle, maybe somebody else comes in there if they're not completely sold on Terry and company, but Elijah Simmons, and I don't know. We'll see what happens to the defensive tackle spot. But ultimately, linebackers are set, safeties are set with Jalen and Trey, but corner is a question mark, and I don't know who's going to step up there. But Ryan, are you more concerned heading into this summer at the corner spot for Tennessee's depth or the tackle spot?
Man, that's a good question. But because both, you mm-hmm. hit the nail on the head about, and to me, really, the question is the whole secondary. While it's not, you have the guys back at safety. Mm. Those guys didn't play well last year. So where's the performance? Is it going to be those guys, Trayvon Flowers, you to use your phrase earlier, turned a lot of heads in the spring. Mm. All the coaches were very, very, high praise for him, but at the same time, those guys were not effective last year. So as a whole, in a secondary that was not great, you lost. You had two guys that played really well in a secondary that was still mediocre at best, and you lose those two guys. So just tons of questions at the secondary spot. And while they've brought in a handful of guys, I think the Ohio State transfer Andre Turrentine, I like him a lot, but again, he seems more like a safety, not necessarily a plug and play corner. So I guess I would lean there just because you need more bodies. At the end of the day, you feel good about four of your offensive line starters, and it's just replacing Cade Mays, who's going to start at that tackle spot. And you hope that they can scheme around it some. I mean, look, Cade Mays missed whatever it was, three or four games last year. It wasn't like they never played with him not on the field, and while the offensive line was certainly worse, they still had good offensive performances. I mean, he didn't play in that Kentucky game. The offense was humming. So it's – probably, I just think probably maybe the tiebreaker there is just the overall confidence in the offense and the overall confidence in Heupel to scheme around it. Maybe some issues at tackle. But at the same time, if you're looking at Tennessee making some sort of real huge jump to 10-2, playing in the Sugar Bowl, Peach Bowl, name whatever, New Year's Six Bowl, Tennessee's going to need to be a lot better on the offensive line. And I think that goes kind of for the same way I said with safeties. I think those interior offensive line, the offensive line is a whole last year was good. But how many times did Tennessee line up on 3rd-and-1, 4th-and-1, and run it up the middle and not get it? I mean, we criticized Heupel for his lack of creativity in those moments, but at the same time, there's going to be plays you're going to reach those goals in a season where you have to line up and be able to help physical people. And Tennessee's offensive linemen who were back and who were pretty good last year weren't able to do that most of the time last year. So you wonder what overall the offensive line, how much those other four guys can improve and maybe help out that offensive tackle spot as well.
Yeah, what do you think, Ethan?
I'd agree with Ryan that it's a tough question, but I'd go corner, I think, after thinking about it. It's kind of an opposite problem that the wide receiver room has, because wide receiver, you have a lot of talent. And corners, there's a lot of guys. I'd argue there's a lot of guys. There's not a lot of guys that can contribute. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got Christian Charles, you got Deshaun Rucker, you got Kamal Hayden, you got Brandon Turnage, but none of those guys are proven. Not really. I'd say Turnage gives you the best bet of that room, but he's more of a star nickel. And you know, it's just there's a lot of playing around, I feel, for Tim Banks to do this season. I personally like Christian Charles a lot. I didn't even mention D'Amico Slaughter, by the way, but I like Christian Charles a lot. I think he has the possibility to really take a big step up this season. They've been raving about him in spring practice, I know that, and you know, he kind of gets injured in the middle of last year and kind of falls off a cliff a little bit at the end, but he was really playing well against Pitt, had that punt block against them. And then, you know, just during the early, I get it's against not great teams, against Tennessee Tech, stuff like that, but I think he showed a lot of potential, and he could have an opportunity to maybe play, I don't know, mess around at that nickel spot, maybe cornerback. Might not be big enough for that nickel spot, but he could, I feel like, vie for losing Alante with maybe Kamal Hayden or Turnage, given how you how Banks wants to do that, I guess.
They want Turnage. Like, he needs to be good. And then, yeah, the Ohio State kid, we'll see what he does in this scheme and if he plays at all this fall. But I don't know. We'll see. I think that is something to monitor, though, with Tennessee and the expectations from national folks on Tennessee is just that, like, hey, if the wins don't come or there are some bumps in the road this year, I think it comes from the offensive line taking a step back from where they were a year ago and Hendon getting beat up a little bit more. That's a possibility. Not being able to run the ball the same way is another possibility. We have a lot more uncertainty in the running back spot. Talent, I think there's more talent and there, but still some question marks. And then you look at the secondary, they're still getting cooked and we're not getting a prep. Like, there's still not a lot of consistent pass rusher where we're just relying so much on Byron Young and Tyler Barron, who are good players, but you want a rotation. A lot of the top end SEC schools, just like at Georgia, like, they just have guys like Jermaine Johnson couldn't find the field. So he transferred to Florida State and just pops off and becomes ACC Defensive Player of the Year and all that. So, like, I wonder about that, of just how much that limits or kind of lowers Tennessee's ceiling in 2022 in year two of Heupel's tenure here on Rocket Top. But I'm excited to see it. Like, I want to see if there is a drop off anywhere. And I wonder, that puts pressure, like, the defense has to get better. Like, that, the offense is going to be elite. It's going to be efficient. Like, we've got that under control. Like, that is something goalish and Heupel, if that ship is moving in the right direction, we're good there. But the next level, if you want to be a 10-win team in the SEC, you want to really challenge Georgia, you want to really challenge the big boys consistently, it's like, the defense cannot be what it was last year, and the talent on that side of the ball cannot be what it is right now. Herring is a good get, like, we'll see, but you need a lot more Caleb Herrings. You need a lot more dudes on that side of the ball to kind of even out both sides of the ball. And I understand it will never be a complete one-to-one scenario with Heupel's offense, but you got to get more guys, and you've got to be more comfortable if you want that. So, like, when people are like, oh, Tennessee should be a 10-win team, I'm like, man, we'll see. We'll see what the secondary looks like. We'll see what the pass rush situation looks like. We'll see if we're better on third downs and getting off the field. We'll see if, like, we'll see. Like, I think there's a sneaky amount of pressure on Tim Banks and company to have a really good year this year, because I think if it's just all Heupel and we're in these just 49-42 games a lot, I don't know. I think there might be more tension there if the defense doesn't get better and isn't making positive strides. But hey, this is what happens when you make this jump and expectations rise, because you're recruiting at this level and you're doing what you're doing. It's just that, like, expectations go up and the defense just has to be better. And it's a fun challenge. And I think Tim Banks is a good coordinator, and I like our staff, but the numbers have to flip a little bit and we have to get better in those areas.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, there's still a lot of long way for the defense to go to be even, you know, comparable to what Georgia's offense has been. I mean, let alone what Georgia's defense has been. And I think you made a good point about the pass rush, because to me, when I look at the secondary, that's going to be a weakness. Like you said, they're not going to magically find three guys to come in and make that a big strength. Now, I think there's a big, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, a big range of what the weakness can be, where it's not debilitating, or it's like it is in the Purdue game, where it is very, very debilitating to your ability to win. And I think the bigger question is, what do those guys at the pass rush spot do? Tyler Barron, Byron Young, I know you'd like to have more depth there. Roman Harrison is back. You have a couple guys. But to me, at the end of the day, it's about those two guys and their ability to get to the passer. Can those guys make a leap? To me, I would think so. Byron Young made massive strides over that course of last season, and he's a guy that's been 1 year in a college program, so he would be ripe to make a big jump. And Tyler Barron's going from his sophomore to junior year, another year you typically see big jumps from players. And to me, for Tennessee's defense, because getting better on third down is a massive, massive part of it, to really make a big jump, I think it's about getting a lot more consistent pressure and not having the blitz if you're going to get home, because for a lot of last year, that really was the case. I mean, Tyler Barron was good early in the year, and then after that, it was kind of Byron Young is going to get there. If he's not going to get there, you better bring pressure, or no one's going to get home. And to me, we know with Tennessee secondary, that's not a good recipe for success, having to bring a lot of pressure. So the the development of those two guys is something that I maybe have the biggest, most keen eye on entering the season.
Yeah, we're at that point where it's like, I don't want the alerts on Jalen Robinson. I want the alert on the five-star corner. Like, give me the alert on that. The big transfer corner from Georgia or Bama who's unhappy. Like, that's when I'm like, oh, I'm perking up a little bit. That's when I'm like, okay, that puts us in a different kind of scope, and that makes me feel a lot better. Like, Eli Ricks. Like, you get that guy in the portal or something. Equivalent player next year. That's when we're like, okay, we're making progress, and this is a step in the right direction. But like you said, Ryan, it's not going to be flipped in one off season, and that's just kind of going to be a weakness this fall. Like, that is something that's going to be a weakness, and you do what you can, and you rely on the coaching to coach these guys up and get it to the point where it's not debilitating and it doesn't cost us games that matter. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. We'll end on this. So Tennessee is behind Florida in the SEC championship odds per Vegas this week. So Matt Green and I were talking about on the full ride this week, and Graham Coffey of Dog Sports is also on. We talked about it a little bit, but Tennessee, same odds on FanDuel, I think, as Kentucky to win the SEC. Florida's above them. Ole Miss is above them. Bama's the favorite, to no surprise. Number two, Georgia. Number three, A&M. Why does, like, it just speaks more to just how important game number four is this fall. And just everything comes down to Florida in Knoxville at Neyland in week four. Like, that's our whole season, is if Tennessee is going to have the building block year, if you're not beating Florida at home this year, and with this rebuilding situation, and you see the number where it's like, oh, why do they have better odds? What does Vegas know? What do the bettors know about Florida this fall that we're not aware of? Because that's a scary thing. If I'm already getting nervous or getting anxiety thinking about being in the stands on that Saturday night. Like, it's just going to be so tense and so uncomfortable throughout that whole game that it's so important. We cannot emphasize this enough, of just how important Florida Tennessee is this fall, because it's just such a deflator if they can't get it done this year. And Richardson's just a star, and maybe that's what it is. They're just betting on Richardson being what a lot of folks think Rattler and company might be. And Jackson Dart is like, well, what it might just be the guy who's been in the program and has aged into the program and just has the physical tools to be a star right away with a competent staff and everything else. So I don't know. It scares me. But Ethan, what do you make of Florida having better odds to win the SEC than Tennessee Vols as it stands right now?
I think it's certainly interesting. I'd say there are three games Tennessee really, really needs to be thinking about this year. It's Florida number one, like you said. I mean, for all the reasons you said, I won't even repeat it, because you hit the nail on the head. I'd say Florida number one, and then you got to do what you couldn't do last year. Really, you got to beat Pitt, even without Kenny Pickett. You got to go in there and beat Pitt. You got to also, like you couldn't do last year, you got to beat Florida. And then I'd say LSU's the wild card, kind of like Ole Miss was this year. You just don't really know, but it'd be nice to get. It'd be a step in the right direction, I'd say. And I guess if I had to put a final note on Florida, that's what I'd say. It's a step in the right direction. You got to beat a first year head coach. I don't care if they've got Richardson. I don't really care what's going on. You got to go in there and beat Florida. And in the state of their program right now, if you can't do it now, it's going to be a while before that happens. You know, with the team, the offense that Heupel's got going, we talk about the struggles on defense, but you got to be able to go in there. Florida,
Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a story we've talked about 10 times the last 10 years. I mean, that Florida game is massive, and outside probably a handful of years in that stretch, Florida has been very much in the realm where Tennessee can beat them from a talent perspective, and the games have oftentimes been very competitive, and it's hard to have a whole lot of confidence in Tennessee to go out and win it when you just don't see them do it often. But you're right. I mean, it would be a debilitating loss. I mean, it's interesting to say the phrase, the honeymoon's over, and that was kind of the first thing I thought about. Well, Heupel really never had the honeymoon because of how dejected everybody was. But since Hendon-Hooker got in there, since the Missouri game last year, the vibes have been very, very good for Josh Heupel. And not many people outside of, I guess, Vols picks on Twitter have done a whole lot of complaining about him. If Tennessee loses to Florida, the complaints will be coming. And if Tennessee beats Florida, Josh Heupel could be elected governor the next day. So it's really as simple as that. It's a massive, massive game. I feel like I've been higher on Florida than most have. I'm a big Anthony Richardson guy. I've watched Tennessee try to defend running quarterbacks last year. It didn't give me a whole lot of reason for me to...
Had to mute him for a second, Ethan. He was going to Anthony Richardson here.
That's fair.
Let me tell you, if Matt Corral is running for 160 on Tennessee's defense, the playmaking ability of Anthony Richardson gives me a reason to have concern for Tennessee against him. But no, I mean, I think it's going to be a competitive game. And like we've all said, it's a very, very important game for Tennessee's season and for Tennessee's program, because it's the first year of Billy Napier, because it's at home, because you don't get him in Neyland in two more years, and because Georgia and Alabama are so, so good. And those are Tennessee's two other biggest rivals, and that's who the fans really want to beat. And that's not a realistic ask for Josh Heupel right now. Beating Florida is a realistic ask. He needs to do it because it's the only one.
Yeah. It's I'm excited. This season cannot come soon enough. Are we sure that Tennessee didn't get involved in the NIL just to put Addison out of there? Like, it wasn't actually we don't want you on Rocky Top, but we'll just funnel you somewhere else. We'll throw our money into the hat to get you out of there for the pick game. Like, we don't want you there because we got to win that one. I don't know. Like, would you give up? Would you sacrifice Pitt to beat Florida? Do you think most Tennessee fans would?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Okay.
Find me the Tennessee fan that wouldn't would be my question.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so.
Ball picks.
Yeah. Ethan, you have nothing to promote because you don't work anywhere anymore. You're just you're a free agent.
We got big things coming. I'll say that much. We got things coming in the pipeline, I guess. I'll say.
There you go. Ryan, you're still gainfully employed and also graduating, so I appreciate you pushing till the end, unlike a certain other co-host on this podcast. But Ryan, what about you? What do you got going on at Rocky Top this week?
Yeah, plenty of baseball stuff from this weekend, looking at the pitching stuff and a couple different pieces on that. And then a ton of stuff on the site between me and Rick Butler on Julian Phillips and what sort of impact that'll have for the Vols next fall and winter.
There you go. There you go. Ryan, Ethan, thank you as always. And I will talk to you both next week. So. All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I am now joined by a first timer. He is an expert in all things Giant Hawks. People would not think so, but yes, that was a thing in the early 80s with the Iowa Hawkeyes. Some of the best uniforms in college football, one of my favorite logos, and a program that I think is in an interesting spot. It's Tom Kakert. Tom, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on and able to talk a little bit about Iowa football.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know you don't get to do it enough. You don't get to do it enough, Tom. So, and I think a lot of my Knoxville and Atlanta folks, it's kind of wild. I, originally from Atlanta, and I just, even the neighbor across the street from my parents' house, Iowa stuff in their house. And, I saw a weird amount of Iowa stuff in Atlanta, not as much in Knoxville, I've noticed, but, Iowa, they're all over the place. So I think there's going to be some crossover here with some Iowa folks who are like, oh, awesome, Iowa coverage. But I want to start with the spring game. So
what
did you take away? Was there anything that you could really pull? I know it depends on who you talk to about, like, what you can really glean from spring game, and everyone's spring games are under different circumstances where, like, Tennessee didn't have any corners. So it's like, what can you really gauge from it? What did you gauge from the Iowa spring game this year?
Iowa was kind of in the same boat. It was a lot of guys were out or they were trying to keep them safe. Not risk them in that final practice. So it was the shortest spring game that we've ever seen. It was really short. It was like an hour and a half between the practice and the scrimmage part. So usually it's about 2 hours, 2:15, something like that. So it was really short. Not a lot to glean. Everybody's talking about the quarterbacks because that's what we do, you know. Because there is kind of a quarterback race, if you will, but and the guy who's the incumbent, Spencer Petras, didn't look great out of the gate, but the two guys behind him, Alex Padilla, who played some last year, and Joe Labus, who was a redshirt last year, redshirt freshman, both those guys looked really good early, and then about midway, Petras looks good. And the other two guys paid back a little bit. So it's kind of, I walked away going, yeah, we're about where we started. So I'll just, the thing I always come back to is I expect that Petras is going to start. And then if things go poorly, maybe the rope's a little tighter this time around.
What do fans want? Do when you're on the rivals boards and you're reading what fans are clamoring for? Is it Padilla? Is it Petrus? Is it like bring back Deuce Hogan? Is it Labas? Like, who is it? Who is the guy?
Yeah, it's interesting because they've kind of gotten out on Petrus. I mean, that first year coming out, the pandemic year was his first year as a starter. Mm-hmm. It was just a tough situation. He had spent a lot of time in quarantine, just never getting COVID, but just being exposed or being in close contacts kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he just, the continuity just never got there with the pass game. They got better kind of towards the end of the year, but it was still up and down. Mm-hmm. And last year it was up and down. We got to see Padilla last year. He actually started a couple games, came in relief at Northwestern when Petrus was hurt and clearly couldn't go. After one series, it was real clear that they're not going to be able to play him. So Padilla came in, but you know, overall his stats were not any better than Petrus. He had 2 interceptions, 2 touchdowns, completed 49% of his passes. They weren't great. So they went back to, in fact, the second half of the Nebraska game, they went back to Petrus and he rallied them to a win at Nebraska. So, and he started the Big Ten championship game, which was a disaster for Iowa, and then started the bowl game. So I think usually they clamor for the backup. Everybody's kind of like, yeah, Padilla's probably ahead of Petrus, but we're not Labas is like the flavor of the month right now. He just is.
Is there something different about him? Does he bring something different to the table? He's a redshirt freshman. Like is it just because of the youth and just the unknown with him? He's just the unknown quantity. Is that all it is?
Yeah. And he got some buzz last year, scout team. So he wasn't even running the Iowa offense, but he was doing scout team and kind of a little edge to him, kind of a little bit of toughness and moxie. And I had gone to see him actually as a high school player during the pandemic year. Just drove out to Ohio because didn't have anything else to do really. So I went to see him play high school game, and he's got some toughness to him. He's got a little edge to him. Not a cannon for an arm, but a good arm, solid arm. He's got he's a good baseball player. So he's got some whip to it, but he's just a fresh face, and Kirk Ferentz has kind of poo-pooed him and a little bit, just saying, he hasn't even run our offense really yet. Let's slow the roll. And one thing I've found out just during the off season is that they've kind of simplified the offense a little bit. There was a comment that Alex Padilla made in leading up to the bowl game about how it took like a year and a half to master the Iowa offense. Now you would think, boy, that's weird because it doesn't seem like a very, sophisticated offense.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do is they ask the quarterbacks to do a lot of different things, reading the defense and adjusting at the line more than other college programs would.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of what they're doing. But I think they've simplified some of the pass game stuff. They've brought in an analyst for the quarterback position. The quarterback coach, Ken O'Keefe, retired. So Brian Ferentz, who's an offensive line coach by trade, offensive coordinator now, he's now the quarterback's coach. He had never played the position, let alone coached it.
Mm-hmm.
So they've brought in a guy named John Budmeyer, who was at Wisconsin and worked under Paul Chryst. Then last year went to Colorado State, was the OC under Steve Adazio and also the quarterback coach there. Now Adazio and those guys got bounced after the year.
Mm-hmm.
So Budmeyer just didn't have a gig. So they were pretty fortunate and get him in as an analyst. So I think he's doing some work, just kind of trying to simplify the offense, simplify some of the things that the quarterbacks are doing. And based on what the quarterbacks have said, it seems like it's been a help to them.
That's interesting. And I mean, there was a lot of talk. I mean, one of the frustrating things I imagine for Iowa fans is just that, like, you had this all-time great defense and the takeaways was just unreal. It was just an unreal run where the defense was doing everything possible to keep this Iowa team moving in the right direction. And you get all the way up into the top five in the country, and you're like, oh, this is now a possibility. Ohio State's down a little bit. They haven't figured out their defense. Like, the Big Ten's more open than it's been in a long time. Wisconsin's still dealing with the Graham Mertz saga there, yeah. And they finally don't have a running back they can rely on for most of the year. Like, it's open for us. Mm-hmm. Like, it felt early on last year. It's amazing, like, hindsight being 2020, but, like, it just... You have to go back and read the pieces. You have to go back and watch and how we talked about Iowa in September and August and even October, and then where we came to at the end, and people remember the Michigan game and what happened there. But it was just, I'm so curious if you're an Iowa fan, because you're like, man, if we just have an average offense last year, we're not in the 99th percentile of just all-time bad struggles with this kind of defense, why couldn't we be a smaller version of what Georgia did with Stetson and company? Because the defenses were pretty similar. Like, Iowa, the takeaways, what they were doing, and just how dominant that defense was, you're like, man, that kind of feels like a wasted opportunity, because you don't know when the Big Ten will be that open again and when you'll have that kind of special defensive season. I mean, Iowa's defense, you bet on it a lot, but, man, I don't know. Like, was that something you were thinking about where you're like, they're going to be kicking themselves this offseason, where it's like that defense and that takeaway stuff was just unbelievable and our offense should not have been that bad? Like, it just, the disparity between the offense and defense cannot happen again.
It's been a great run for the Iowa defense for several years, really, where they've had this level of play where they're getting, you know, 20, 30 takeaways, 20, 30 sacks. You know, they had a great run with guys like AJ Epinesa and Anthony Nelson, and Davion Nixon was the, you know, defensive player of the year in the Big Ten a couple of years ago, the pandemic year. And they've just continued to churn out. Phil Parker, he's got it figured out. The only school that's really figured them out on a consistent basis defensively has been Purdue. Jeff Brom's got his number. And I don't know what it is, but they've been, I do a podcast during the football season with Chuck Long, who's a Iowa quarterback, runner up to Heisman Trophy in 85 season to Bo Jackson. And Chuck coached Oklahoma. Chuck was head coach at San Diego State. He knows the game, and he's of the opinion that Iowa has probably missed out on at least two other Western division championships because the offense has just been not good enough. And last year it was kind of a perfect storm that got them into that Big Ten championship game, because they had their kind of in control, and then they just didn't play well in a couple games and gave some things back, but ended up getting in there. So thanks to the Gophers beating Wisconsin.
Do you think it's because it's interesting that you brought up the Brian Ferentz offensive verbiage and what they ask of these quarterbacks? Do you think part of that is to blame for the issues the last couple of years, is that they do it, the scheme is so complicated and that it's so thought out and they ask so much of the quarterbacks that, like, there's not enough juice. It's not free flowing enough. It's just so interesting. Like, I highly encourage folks to watch an Iowa game and then watch Heupel's offense right after, and just see the disparity between the two. And it's not like it's wrong. And I would just love to know what Brian and Kirk are thinking, like what their strategy is there, or like why they don't adjust, because it seems like it is a level of stubbornness a little bit, right? Where they're like, this is the way that and part of it for me, I wonder, is like, we don't want to sacrifice the defense to flip up a lot, right? Like, that feels like a big part of it.
Yeah, that is part of it. It's one hand washing the other kind of thing, and trying to do things. It's the defense is gonna they'll give you the opportunity to maybe march down the field a little bit, but they're gonna play bend but don't break kind of defense, and they're gonna force you into mistakes because they're not gonna make the mistakes. They're gonna play. Yeah. You know, quarter half coverage a lot in the secondary, and guys are just very disciplined. They do what they're supposed to do, and they're sure tacklers. So they just Phil Parker has a thing that he shared with us a couple of years ago, and it's basically, if they give up two or fewer explosive plays, like 25 yards or more in a game, the opposing team is going to score 14 points or less. On that defense. Now they may, you know, have a pick six or something, you know, get a funny money kind of touchdowns. But if they give up more than two, they're going to probably give up 28 points. So it's about limiting those big plays. And on offense, Kirk's philosophy is always going to be, want to be balanced, want to run the football. That's just kind of how he's always going to be. It was funny because a couple of years ago with Tyler Goodson, they started running the Wildcat for a little bit. And he used to joke about, he used to like snicker when somebody bring up the Wildcat. He'd be, maybe we'll go out and run the Wildcat. You know, and then he did it. And but then it disappeared by the end of the year, or the next year. It just kind of went away. But for Iowa, Iowa's unique because I think everything really starts up front on both sides of the ball. It's not as much about a quarterback or, in fact, Brian Ferentz this spring called the quarterback position a facilitator, which raised some eyebrows.
Yeah.
Because I'm guessing that like Josh Heupel will not look at his quarterback as a facilitator.
No.
He's going to look at him as a playmaker. That's just kind of where Iowa's philosophy is at. So, but it all starts up front with the offensive line. And the offensive line last year was, you know, even though they had Tyler Linderbaum, who was a first-round draft pick of the Ravens, Remington Award winner, the offensive line wasn't great last year. They gave up 32 sacks last year. They only averaged 3.4 yards per carry last year. They had a lot of negative yardage plays. And if Iowa is starting to drive second and nine, that's like them playing left-handed. This is not, that's not the world they can live in. They need to start second and five. So that was part of it. Now the defensive line, which was a lot of new faces, but they really played well. And I think they're going to be good again next year, this coming year. And they've got, you know, Riley Moss back on defense at corner. They've got, Jack Campbell, who I think is one of the best linebackers in the country at middle linebacker. So they got some dudes on defense, but it's going to come down to the offensive line, in my opinion. And if they get some decent quarterback play, if they do that, they'll win 9-10 games. If they don't, it might be 7.
And you're bringing in, there's a 5-star at Iowa, right? There's a 5-star. So that's pretty much locked in, right? He's an Iowa kid. I think Bama was the only other serious competitor for him.
He came in early too. He enrolled early. Okay. This year they had, there's another kid that they brought in early, TJ Hall, who's a cornerback that I think's got a chance to play this year too. I think he's as good a corner as they've had as a true freshman. They kind of mentioned at the same level as Desmond King, who won the Thorpe Award. So. Yeah. So that's some pretty heady company there. So we'll see. Wampa is, you know, they have this cash position, which is kind of the hybrid, one of the linebacker positions, but they just kind of use, they've used a safety in that position.
So it's kind of like a star.
Yeah. We'll call it a star or I don't know. All these guys use those different.
Yeah.
Technology for
it, but I like Cash though. Cash pretty cool.
Cash, and he and the last two guys that have played that are got drafted in the NFL. Monty Hooker, who's with the Titans,
and then
Dane Belton got drafted this year by the Giants. So there's a kid that they probably are going to plug in there. Now, Wampa might be in there too, but there's another kid that's just, he's one of the best players that I've seen at the high school level, just unreal. Kid named Cooper DeGene. He's a small town 1A football kid in Iowa. And he's just one of those kids that ball finds him. So I think they're trying to find ways to get him on the field. He played mainly special teams, but he's probably a safety by trade, but he was even playing corner last year a little bit late in the year when they were thin on numbers.
Interesting. I wonder too, for Iowa, there's some programs where I look at it where I'm like, okay, you kind of know who you are. The ethos is going to be the ethos. The identity is entrenched. And mm-hmm. one of the things that you can do, like if you're an Iowa fan, you're like, okay, if we're going to be committed to this style of play and we're going to be committed to our quarterback being a facilitator, or what it was that the word you used? Facilitator?
Yeah.
Yeah. And not a playmaker. Okay. Well, the transfer portal exists now. Like, you can develop and do everything you want to do, but if you're frustrated with the inconsistencies of a Spencer Petras and you don't want to deal with a redshirt freshman under center that everybody wants, why not dip into the portal? Why not go after an upperclassman that sure. can pop, and someone who has been just kind of what Nebraska did. They go after Casey Thompson. K-State brings in Adrian Martinez. Like, yep. Why has Iowa not been more active in the quarterback transfer portal market?
Yeah, they simple answer is they feel like if they go in and get a quarterback that two mm-hmm. are that then that's going to cost them two more.
Huh.
And so they don't know that the person that they're going to get is better than what they have. So they're just like, bird in the hand kind of thing.
Yeah. But you try it once. You see what happens. Like, I think you had to dip out on that ledge at some point. Everybody, like, that's one of those, everybody's doing it, man. And I understand that too, though. I mean, Tennessee's dealing with that a little.
I'll say this. Iowa has not had a lot of turnover in the portal. I mean, I think yeah. they're number two least number of kids that have left them to the portal. I think they only had five guys leave, and that's, like, abnormally low for mm-hmm. these days.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of it is the culture. And I think part of it is also, I think some of the kids are probably smart enough to realize that maybe the grass is not going to be as green because some guys that have left haven't, you know, they'll end up, like, for example, one of the wide receivers that left last year, he ended up at Northern Iowa, going down a level. So, yeah. You know, unless you've got something, to me, that's the big thing with the portal is these kids just make bad decisions, because if you don't know going into the portal that there's going to be three or four schools that are at that same level or higher, they're going to be there for you. I don't know if you risk it. Why risk it?
So it requires some tampering. Only enter the portal with some well-vetted tampering.
That's the only way to get in there. It is. Yeah. And some of these, but yeah, well vetted would be the right word for it too, because some of these guys just they get people telling them the wrong thing. They get bad advice.
People,
it's unbelievable to me.
It requires so much nuance, and just when you hear a lot of national talking heads or folks talk about it, or people, there's so much more going on behind the scenes, and it's so much more complicated in the way that people want to discuss it, but. If you push back against anything in the portal or anything like that, it's like, oh, you can't be anti-player. And it's like, well, no, there's some real issues, and there's some real stuff that's happening behind the scenes. And there's a lot of kids being pushed in the wrong direction and being lied to by adults. And I think it was Aaron Taylor who had a good rant actually about this of like,
good video.
Yeah. Like we need, like there needs to be some accountability. Like we have to protect these kids in a different kind of way where it's like they're getting led astray by different people and they're getting a lot of folks in their ear. And you know
what they need is you know, when guys put their name in, before they put their name in for the draft, they can get advice and get feedback. It's almost be worthwhile for the portal, for the NCAA to set up a feedback thing where the kid can get feedback and say, yeah, you're probably not going to get any other D1 offers.
Yeah.
If you want a high D1 or Power 5 school offers, but you may get want to go play somewhere, but you may have to go play at South Dakota State or Dakota State or Northern Iowa. And those are great programs. They're just not going to be on TV every Saturday.
I struggle with it because if I was in their shoes, like I understand where it's like you're putting a lot of faith in these coaches. They're like, hey, if you stay and you keep working, like you'll get there. And you're like, well, I only get one shot at this, man. And for some of these kids, it's like I get one shot at changing my life and my family's life forever. And it's just, it's a lot of trust, and it's a lot of difficult decisions that each of these kids have to make and think about. And they just put a lot of trust into folks they don't really know that well, which is also pretty scary.
And it's a financial decision now too, with lots of kids. Mm-hmm. It's a financial decision that they're making as much as it is a football decision, because they're going to be offered financial rewards like Jordan Addison is, or you know, guys like that, that are going to make a lot of money as a college football player, and more power to them. I mean, you know, nobody's standing in the way of that, but
you cannot stand in the way of it and also recognize that it's bad for the sport, right? There's like this weird thing where people are like, oh, well, it's finally fair. I was listening to two folks that I really respect in college sports media, and I just disagreed, where it's like there is a misunderstanding, I think, nationally. And I think you being on the ground in Iowa and just interacting with so many fans and seeing what fans are like, kind of me being in Knoxville and just being here and being a grad student and just being around Tennessee a bunch, is that there's a complete misunderstanding of what fans want and what they're worried about and their long-term concerns for college football and things like that. Where I think something you miss is like, can you imagine if Larry Fitzgerald leaves Pittsburgh after his freshman year and just transfers to Alabama or Clemson or whatever and finishes his career out there? You can say, yeah, it was probably more financially lucrative for him to make that move while he was in college, but it worked out for him. But like, the whole reason that we watch college football is like, those kind of stories are cool. Like the West Virginia Pat White teams are cool. The surprise Marshalls with Byron Leftwich and Chad Pennington and Moss. And like, when you see programs where talent is scattered all across the country and you find these diamonds in the rough, or like these awesome stories that make you want to watch Pitt or keep up with Pitt or keep up with Iowa, because it's like, oh, Drew Tate is a wild man, I got to watch Drew Tate. Like, that is something that's really cool and you want to do that. But if they become feeder schools for the big dogs because they can't financially compete the same way, then you have a major problem. Like, you can say, yeah, this is better for Jordan Addison, but you can also say, this is bad for the sport. Like, this is bad for viewership, and fans don't want this. And those are the people who are ultimately paying to go to these games. So you have to consider both here. You have, like, it can be good for players, and that's fine, and we're pro player, but you can also be honest about the ramifications that it has for the folks that love college football to begin with, right?
I'll tell you the because I brought this up on our message boards recently about just kind of taking the temperature of the room with Iowa fans and how many of them would contribute to a collective. Because I was trying to get one going. You know, I know Tennessee's got this Fire Sports thing.
Oh, yeah, we're moving.
They're dishing out money left and right. I mean, they're getting millions of dollars.
Hold on. Allegedly, Tom.
Allegedly. Allegedly millions of dollars to allegedly. And, but they're doing things. Tyler Casper was one of the kids that they were after. I know Tyler for a long time. Kevin, his dad played at Iowa. So, you know, Iowa fans are just not, they're not comfortable in that world. This whole we're paying players now is just kind of like, yeah, this isn't the pool we've grown up in. It's just not, it's not in the DNA of Iowa athletics. So, and it never has been. So it's going to be a challenge for Iowa fans. Cause I know I've talked to a couple of big boosters at Iowa, and they're of that opinion. They're like, yeah, I don't know if I'm going to really get involved with it.
Huh?
Because they're just like, I just don't feel comfortable. I love supporting Iowa athletics and the foundation and trying to build better facilities. But, you know, the arms race for facilities is over, right? It's done. I mean, that's old news now. The arms race now is going to be who can offer the most money to players. That's what it's going to be. That's the arms race. And you're either going to be involved in it or you're going to fall back.
Yeah.
You know, and I think some places the infrastructure was there and hit the ground running, and then other places it's not, and there's scuffling. I mean, Iowa's scuffling to get this thing going. They'll get it going, but it's just not gonna, you know, it might be
happen overnight.
It might be just a couple million dollars.
Yeah.
Whereas,
but I think that's always been kind of the case with college football, though, right? Like, players have been getting paid. Like, the buckets of cash. I think it's just the difference when I've talked to folks who've been in the know for a long time. It's been like, oh, instead of 50K under the table, it's now 8 million. Like, it's just a totally different amount of money and a totally different crazy amount of money for top recruits now.
And that's why Nick Saban was mad about all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. He's mad because they were probably doing things differently. Mm-hmm. Able to do operate in that world, and now everybody can operate in that world and openly. And
I think it's partly that, but I also think Saban knows that he's gonna, like, it's one of those where he's like, all right, you want to do the portal, guess what, Eli Ricks and Jahmyr Gibbs are on the way. You just want a title with this guy, guess what, I'm bringing Burton in right after the
Say he didn't there's no tampering ever.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just I think Saban speaks in a way that's everything that he says is very pointed and calculated. And I don't know. He's just too smart. And it's just one of those where I like Saban a lot, but it is what it is. He's telling you, like, this is what's going to happen. If you want to go down this road, I'll go down this road with you, but you don't want Alabama athletics and myself at the helm going down this road with you. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. We'll end on this, Tom. So, when you look at the schedule for Iowa football this fall, what pops for you? What is there a stretch of games that you're like, all right, this will define Iowa season? What is it for you when you look at it? Does it feel like a Big Ten title or conference championship game appearance again, or no?
Could be. I think the key stretch is that October stretch around the Ohio State game. There's just Iowa hasn't gone to Ohio State for, God, I think it's been 8 years now. It's just weird schedule.
Well, pods are coming, sir. ACC throwing them out there in 2023, and I've heard Big Ten might even be before them.
Yeah, they're going to do pods, so like Iowa will probably, I think, almost assuredly have Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Nebraska in their pod with them, and then kind of play outside that with other games.
And Nebraska's become basically their rival, right? Is that real? Is this like the corn rival? Can we get a corn, like a some sort of corn statue or some...
That's the Cy-Hawk game. That's the Iowa
State. But I want corn for Cornhuskers in Iowa. I need some other corn related statue or something.
Yeah, the Iowa State one's always the corn one.
Yeah.
The corn bowl, if you will. And then Minnesota's the pig. And then Wisconsin's a bull. The Heartland Trophy, but the Nebraska one's been this Heroes Trophy where they honor people who've done good things, and that's great, but it doesn't pop the way it should. The only thing that's been cool is that it's really stuck with Black Friday, which I think has been nice. I like having that Friday game. I really do, because it's just it's sort of nice, especially when it's in Iowa City. So I don't have to travel to Lincoln, and you're just home, and Saturday you can watch football all day.
What's the drive to Lincoln for you?
Lincoln's probably about 5 hours.
Okay.
5 hours. So it's not terrible. Usually drive out to Omaha on Thanksgiving Day and then just drive into Lincoln on Friday.
There you go.
So yeah, the bottom line, the schedule, it's, just around that Ohio State game, there's some tough things. Michigan comes to Iowa City around that same time, too. So it's just that stretch is going to be a challenge, I think, for Iowa. If they can navigate that, and then they're always going to finish, seems like they load up with the divisional games in the last month. So it's like Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin at the end. So I always think like Iowa, Wisconsin is kind of like whoever wins that one generally has control of things. But I think Minnesota's going to be pretty good. I think Illinois is going to improve. And Nebraska, I'll believe it when I see it.
Okay. That's fair. They're fun, though. The Cardiac Huskers, they're fun, man.
3-9.
The best 3-9 team in college football history, sir.
Yes, that's what we've been told.
Mm-hmm. Tom, how do the good folks check out your work and everybody else across Hawkeye Report?
Yeah, go to HawkeyeReport.com or Iowa.Rivals.com. You can hop on there. I'm at Hawkeye Report on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So you can check us out there as well. Covering a lot of things. We're, you know, ramped up our baseball coverage. I know that's sort of an SEC sport, but we've got a lot of good baseball coverage, too, for the Iowa baseball team, who's on their way to another 30-win season, and hopefully they're going to squeak in the NCAA tournament.
Okay. You don't want to date with my Tennessee Volunteers.
No, that Tennessee offense is just it's like the 27 Yankees.
It's a lot of fun, man. I being in attendance and being here for this, I think we're gonna go to Omaha, my dad and I think we're gonna book it. Like, I don't know if we'll ever see a Tennessee baseball team this good ever again. Like, this is just like one of a kind, in a lot of ways. So I'm excited. We'll see what happens. We've got to finish up with Georgia this weekend and then go to Mississippi State next weekend. So we'll see. Tom, thank you so much for making the time today. I greatly appreciate it. And we'll have to check back in again soon.
Thanks for having me on, Chase.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the Chase Thomas Podcast. Thank you again to Tom, Ryan, and Ethan for coming on today's edition of the podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed all the Tennessee and Iowa coverage here at the Chase Thomas Podcast, and in particular this episode. If you enjoyed this episode and you have not already done so, make sure to go hit that pause button and leave this show a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That is how you are listening to this very podcast and have not done so already. You can email the program at chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com with any sports questions, show questions, you know, anything like that. Just chasethomaspodcast@gmail.com. Go visit Sports Renaissance Man. Sports Renaissance Man. That's me. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. All my writing over there. Just type in your email and never miss any of my written content by just joining up there. SportsRenaissanceMan.substack.com. Watch us on YouTube. Oh yeah, every episode, clips, all that good stuff on youtube.com. Type in the Chase Thomas Podcast and you'll find us there. Follow me on Twitter at @Chase_Thomas and like the Facebook page at facebook.com/Chase Thomas Writer. All right, might not have a new episode coming up tomorrow. Sports Reporters Assemble might be off this week. And then me saying Thomas also looks like it's gonna be off this week. Heading into Monday, it's just I got a lot on my plate with school and I'm still trying to wrap up here, so once I get a handle on that over the next couple of days so I can wrap up and finish this semester strong, then we'll be in good shape. But you know, I gotta wrap that up first and then bounce back over here. So a lot of fun stuff planned for the summer and all that good stuff, but we got to keep grinding, and I got to wrap up here at Tennessee. So we'll see how the rest of the weekend, early part of next week goes. But just keep that in mind if the schedule's a little wonky, because we've been coming out 3 a.m. East Coast time every single day. So that might change just a bit this weekend. So we'll see. Obviously, you guys will be aware. And yeah. All right. Well, I got to run. And Uncle Derek, how'd I do?
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.